Today is April 9th, 1976. This is a continuation of the interview with Mr. Charles Simmons, begun on March 26th. Mr. Simmons, I wanted to begin this afternoon by having you talk about the work that your father did with the Fairbanks Morris. Now, as I recall, he was one of the earliest black employees at Fairbanks Morris. And I was wondering if you could tell us about his experience there, the work that he did and his experience as one of the first black workers.
Well, my father came here, in the latter part of 1912, and was employed as a fireman in what was then number one boiler room. At that time they had two boiler rooms, number one and number two. And my father was in number one for quite a few years. And then they transferred him to number two. And he worked there. Oh, he worked there for, I can't tell you exactly how long. He worked there for quite a while, and then he was transferred from the boiler room, from the firing, to a crane operator in the old foundry, what was known then as the old foundry. And he worked as a crane operator in the old foundry for, I would say, 8 or 10 years. And during that time, while he was working in the foundry, he went hunting. And I'm bringing this in because he went hunting. He wasn't working. This was on a weekend. He went hunting, and while he was out hunting, he had one of these pump guns. And somehow or another, a shell exploded in the gun and hit it in the forearm. And they tried to save that arm, and they finally had to cut it off just above the elbow. And he came out of that all right, went back to work at Fairbanks, then in the foundry. Again, for at that time, Mr. Barr was the superintendent. He went as a sand mixer. He operated the sand mixer machines, and he stayed there until he retired. He served he was one of the first members of the 20th Century Club, they called it then. And he...
What was the 20th Century Club exactly?
After you worked at Fairbanks Morris 20 years, you belonged to the 20th Century Club. And my father was lucky enough to belong to that. And he was quite a fisherman, loved to fish, he loved to hunt. But after losing his arm, couldn't do much hunting, but he still fished. And he enjoyed that. He enjoyed gardening. He always had a garden. And he belonged to church. He was active in church work. At one time, he belonged to Bethel AME Church, was a trustee at Bethel AME Church. But since he was a Baptist before, it was a Baptist church here in Beloit, he stayed and joined a Methodist church. Later, after Emmanuel Baptist was organized, he left Bethel and went and helped to organize Emmanuel Baptist. He and my mother too, so... he died here about 6 or 7 years ago.
Do you know why he made the switch from Bethel to Emmanuel?
Yes, he was Baptist before. It wasn't that anything caused, it wasn't anything that he disliked about the church. It was just when he came here, it wasn't but one church in town. And it wasn't no Baptist church here. At that time, it was very few blacks here. And this church was organized, oh, about 100 years before he got here. So that's what he, it was about the history of him, you know, here in Beloit. He was very well liked among everybody. Everybody knew him. They called him Bob Mayo. So
did he always feel, did he feel that he was treated fairly at Fairbanks Morris?
Yes, he didn't feel that he had any gripes. I never heard him gripe about anything, about the way he worked. Or, in fact, I think he felt that he was given a good break when, after losing his arm, that was his right arm that he lost, Fairbanks Moore still employed him as, gave him a job as a sand mixer. Because he could operate the machine with his left hand. No, he wouldn't.
So he never complained about discriminatory treatment.
Never complained about discrimination at all.
Yeah.
And after that, well, my brother came here. He came here from St. Louis along about 1920. He was a molder in St. Louis, and he came here, and Fairbanks hired him as a molder, and he passed on here in Beloit. So it wasn't never no discrimination that I could see that we had. Of course, everything, some people looked for things to say they were discriminated against, but truthfully, I can't say it.
I recall in our previous conversation a mention of a safety incident, a problem regarding a fan, and a fellow who put his hand in the fan, and there was no safety guard. And I was wondering if you experienced, if you and other, or you, your stepfather, other workers, frequently experienced safety problems, or whether that was an isolated incident. Just what was the picture with regard to safety at Fairbanks Moore?
Safety at that time, they had a man by the name of Taylor who went around through the shop to find anything that was unsafe, and he had a crew to take care of it immediately, as soon as possible could be done. Now, in this fan that I spoke of some time ago, that fan was put up there a day or two before this happened. And that fan later had a guard put on it, I think within a few hours after this man's hand went in there. But they just erected that fan because they moved the employment office into this end of the building. And they didn't have time to do it. But the safety precaution at that time was very strict. The jitneys, the various cranes, mostly everything they had that was dangerous, they had some kind of safety device on it. Yeah, it was pretty well fixed at that time, safely. And Taylor, this Mr. Taylor, was an elderly man, and sometimes you would think that he was just doing it to keep his job or something, because he was really one of those cronies about safety. If you didn't have your glasses on, if you didn't have your, when you was pouring iron, you didn't have those leggings on, he'd yell at you. But at that time, it was pretty strict on safety.
That's an interesting point. I wanted to ask, too, about your work at Fairbanks Morris, and you started, I believe, in the employment office, and I was wondering just what your work was there exactly.
Well, my job there at the employment office was to take employees to their job, introduce them to their foreman, and to take anyone else, a visitor, whoever it was, to come in, take them to wherever they wanted to go. And then in my spare time, I was a file clerk. I had to file and do things of that kind in the office. That was my job in the employment office. At that time, I was getting 16 and a half cents an hour. And that wasn't enough money. Later on, I worked there for a couple years. And something else I think I should say, because they had at that time a foreman club. It was up the river. And I don't know why they did it for me, but these foremen and superintendents would had a boathouse set down on the river. And they would, these foremen and superintendents would go out to this beefsteak club, they called it. Oh, it must have been 8 or 10 miles up the river. And they would take, they would drive out there, but this foreman from the office, one of the foremen in the office, he wasn't my foreman, but he always would take me and take me up there with him. I would ride up in the boat, take the beefsteaks and whatever they had else on a Saturday afternoon, go, and I'm getting paid right along to do this, ride up the river in the boat and go with them, and I'd have a big picnic up there with them on a Saturday afternoon. And I thought it was real great. Mr. Ingersoll's son and I would be the only two youngsters in the group. And these others were always old, and we would have a real good time. But I left there, after I left the office, I went out in the foundry to work. And I don't know, foundry, I worked there for a while, but it wasn't cut out for me. I just didn't like foundry work. Well, I guess I stayed in the foundry about 2 or 3 years. Then I went in the windmill department and worked there. I don't know, I guess a couple years. Then it got slack. I think I got laid off. It got slack. And later on, I got a job at that time, they had what they call the Winter Malleable here. And I was very lucky. I got a job over there as assistant shipping clerk and timekeeper of the brass foundry. And it was me.
And about when was this? That so you left Fairbanks then?
I left Fairbanks long about, that was long about 1920, 21, somewhere along in there. But I left Fairbanks and went to Winter. I stayed there for a while. And then I didn't go back to Fairbanks until, I guess, 1927. And I only stayed there a little while then. And I came out and went in the garage. And I stayed in the garage. I learned body and fender work. And I worked at that until, I guess, was in about 42. Then I went into dry cleaning business and stayed there until 59, 60, somewhere. Then I was too old to, they went bankrupt, and I was too old to do anything else then, so I had to, I finally found a job that I could do as a night watchman, blow it too. And I worked at that until I retired.
of which of these you've had quite a varied work experience, and I'm wondering which you like best. What satisfied you the most?
Well, I think in my younger days, naturally, I thought more of the body and fender work. But as I grew older, why, that was a little too much for me. And I guess, of course, I stayed dry cleaning about 15 years, something like that. So I liked it pretty good. It was educational, so it was something new and different every day. So
you mean in the dry cleaning work?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, the reason why it was different, right. I was, it was a plant. Well, it was large enough that somebody had to do the pipe fitting and take care of the machinery and all that. So that fell on my lot. I had that job to take care of all the machines and pipe fitting, such work as that. It's something new every day, different. I didn't have the same thing every day.
Now, where was it that you did the body and fender work? Was this
garages? Just here in Beloit.
Yeah, I see. Okay, that was not at one particular. That was at a number of places.
A couple of them.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anything you've disliked about any of in your work experience? Anything?
I can't say there's anything I dislike, because if I disliked it, why I'd jump and get me something else.
Okay.
So up until I married, well, then I had to stick at whatever I wanted to do.
I see. Okay. All right. Were you ever involved in any union activity or union organizing over the
Never
years?
Was. Never was involved in no union. When the union came into Fairbanks, that was the year, I don't remember what year it was, but when they came in that year, before they were really organized, I quit. I came out. So I was never involved in it, so, which I was very thankful for that, in a way. But of course, maybe it would have been different if I had been in it, but I've never been involved with the union at all.
Okay. Now, here again, with at any of these work experiences, did you experience what you considered discriminatory behavior?
No, I haven't. Not in any of the jobs that I've ever had. I don't think that I was treated. In fact, I think some of the jobs that I had, if anything, they made a difference with me. I had the break instead of the other one. No, I don't think I've never been discriminated against.
And what makes you say that you might have gotten the break instead of the other?
Well, one of the last jobs, like in this tailor shop, the man that owned the shop. He is still living, and every so often, and he is about, I think he's around 90 years old. And every so often he comes to see me now. And I know to be a fact that some of the help were white and went to him for favors and they didn't get it. And I went to him. I never went to him to ask anything that I didn't get.
And who was this, by the way?
Fay Hulbert. Mostly all the jobs that I've ever had. I don't think I've been discriminated against. I guess because of one thing, I've been plain and fair. If I didn't think a thing was right, I would let you know right then that I didn't think it was right. And so, no job that I've ever had. Now, I went on one job this year, job that I was night watching on when I was hired. The man that was the superintendent hired me. He says, well, said Charlie, says, I'll tell you. Says, you might have trouble here said, but don't, if you do, let me know, said, because they might say something to you that you don't like, said, you know, they make a difference with me, said, I'm an Indian, said, they make a difference with me down here, said, but there's nothing they can do about it. Says, and if they don't treat you right, you let me know, because there's nothing they can do about you. So, I don't know, somehow or another, I've got the breaks. I just, maybe I was born the right time of the year. No, I really think that I've got breaks sometimes when maybe I didn't deserve them.
Yeah, that's good.
So I have nothing to kick on.
Are there any, involving any of your work experiences, are there any stories that you like to tell? Any stories you tell your grandchildren or anything about work experiences that you'd like to share with us here?
No other story than I tell them, oftentimes I tell them that today, or when I was coming up, the jobs that I had, seemingly I was very poor. Well, the rates at that time was poor for everybody. You didn't get no, it was no big rate pay. It, like when I started, 16 and a half cents an hour was big money. I went in the foundry, I got 20 cents an hour, 4 cents an hour more to go out there and get dirty, which was a very foolish thing as I look back on it today, but I couldn't see it then. And today, you see the kids, the young people, making this big money, sitting down on their duff, coming up because the man, the foreman will tell them they're not doing a good job. They're ready to take them to the union or something of that kind. See, in a way of speaking, that don't make sense to me now that I look at it, you know. Of course, my kids, they always kid, listening. I'm always telling them something about things that happened to me when I was a kid. When, you know, whatever my parents put on the table, that's what we ate. We didn't say, I don't like this, I don't like that, I don't want this, I don't want that. You ate what you had and be thankful. And you didn't go out and your mother didn't buy you a pair of shoes, the kind of shoes you wanted. You didn't holler, I am not going to wear these shoes. You wore them shoes. And I always told my kids when they were coming up, they would do as my wife and I say do, as long as you stay under this roof. Even if you're grown, you do as we say do. Or when you get so that you can't do that, then you got to go. Well, that's the way, of course, my children have been very good. I'll say it. Do knock on wood. They've been very good. I can't complain on them. I've never had to go to nobody's jail or nobody. I haven't even had to go to school for them or anything. So, and they've grown now. All of them got children except one. So I feel thankful.
What do you attribute that change, the change that you just talked about to, you know, the more seemingly more undisciplined family situation, other than what you experienced when you were growing up?
I think it's the parents. See, you can't raise a family and your children here at home and you and your wife down in the tavern or someplace. You can't raise no family that way. So, too many parents are letting the children raise themselves and partially raising the parent.
Now, let's, I wanted to be sure and talk with you a little while about the first groups of migrants who came to Beloit from Mississippi, if we can flash back a little. You were here when the first Mississippians began to move up here. And I was wondering what are your recollections of that movement? What do you recall about that? What are the things that really stand out in your mind now, first of all?
Well, the first group that came up, I was, well, I guess I was, I was proud to see them leave, and come up this way, because not knowing them, in fact, I didn't get to know them, didn't get acquainted with them till later. And most of them, the first group that came up, I admired them very much, because they looked very decent, and it was something, I don't know. And the second or third group, they had some younger ones in it, and it made me feel that sooner or later I'd have some companionship with younger people here. See, where I didn't have too much before, because it was only one family living on one side of town. We lived way over on this side of town, so we didn't get to see each other. See, during that time, you didn't have no automobiles. There was no automobiles here at that time. And every once in a while, somebody'd come by with a horse and buggy. And if you went downtown, well, you walked. The biggest majority of the time, you walked everywhere as you went. So he was glad to see somebody.
Now, did you, or let's say maybe your stepfather, might have expressed a fear that there was this was additional competition for work that you needed?
No. Nope. See, during that time, of course, naturally, I didn't worry about no job. I guess because I was home. My father was working, and my mother, at that time, she did a little catering work around, so I never worried about no... In fact, I just felt that there wasn't nothing, just more people coming.
Huh. Yeah, you seem to accept it as a natural thing, almost not a...
Just as a natural thing, yeah. But see, because I hadn't been too long here before this group came, and I'd been used to seeing a group of people, of color, at black people, as you call it. I'd been used to seeing them and mingling with them, and so it didn't surprise me. See, I went to the eighth grade in the South, in Kentucky. So I didn't mind it so much. In fact, I was glad to see it.
Now, did the migrants seem different to you in any way? After all, you lived in Kentucky.
They talked different, and they some things acted different, and they talked much different, because I never will forget one of the boys when we first started, going around together. He would holler and say, "Come on, help me." I said, "What do you mean? Come on, help me tote this." And see, I didn't know what he's talking about. He meant for me to come and help him to carry whatever he was carrying, help me to tote. And then we get to playing ball, he'd say, "Chunk it to me." Several words like that, it kind of, got under me. But as him and I went around together, he soon picked up my words. And, of course, I never picked up another hope and tote. I think I would have if my mother, a couple of times I went home and said something about hope or tote, and they'd stop me. But I never will forget another time. My dad had a horse. Show you what parents will do. My mother, and my father. They had a horse. Well, we didn't have a horse, but the man up in the next place to us had he had a little light farm up there, and I was up there helping him to do something, and I was think I was doing something with the horse. But anyhow, the horse stepped on my foot. And I told the horse, get your damn foot off of mine. And I didn't know my stepfather was anywhere around. He waited just as nice till I come home for supper. We was all sitting around the supper table. He says to my mother, called her, Kate. Mother said, what? So do you know your son swears? I looked at him and I knew what he was going to say right then. Dropped my head. What did he do? Says, well, he told the horse to get his damn foot over his. My mother started laughing and said, well, I don't blame him. And then the both of them started laughing, see? But I was afraid I was going to get slapped. She would slap you in a minute. So.
Now, I'm wondering, Mr. Simmons, if there are any other customs that the folks from Mississippi brought with them that you noticed that were different, maybe not just language, but maybe other customs as well.
Yes, it was one that was very comical. A lady went downtown, and it was at the corner of Pleasant and Grand Avenue. I never will forget it. She went in the store there and asked the grocery. It was a grocery store there next door to the corner. She asked the grocer to buy a dime's worth of, she said, dime's worth of goobers. And the grocer didn't know what they were. And he said, well, lady, says, if you'll tell me what you are talking about, or give me some definition of what you mean, says, well, next time you come, I'll have them for you. The lady began to get angry and frustrated, and she says, yes, you got them. Says, there they are right here in the case here. You don't want to sell them to me because I'm a Negro. And so the man says, well, we call them peanuts. So he bagged them up and gave them to this lady. And the lady went out the door. She was so mad and flustered. She got outside of the door and threw them out in the street. She wouldn't have them. But that was just a case of where the man didn't know what the woman wanted. Said, because goobers, I'd never heard that word goobers in my life. Until they came up here, goobers were peanuts. And I didn't know what goobers was. Another case, this is about as comical. A lady went down to the Goodwin building at that time. They had an elevator in it. It was four-story building. And that was a building that had, at that time had the real estate offices. It was about the only building that had all offices in it, and she went upstairs. They were taking her and taking them up to see about renting a house. And they went up there and they rented this house, and they went up on the elevator and come down on the elevator. Well, that was all good. They went home. When that woman's husband came home from work that night, she told that man, says, I want you to take me home. Take me back home. What's the matter? Says, yeah, we're making good money. Everything's going along fine. What's the matter now with you? Said, well, I went downtown today, and they put us on scales, and we're weighing us like we were cattle. She went up in the elevator and come down. She thought she was on scales. She didn't know that was the means of transportation. So she got angry about that. Finally, her husband convinced her that she was wrong. Later she began she got a place in later years where she got accustomed to everything, and all the times I used to kid her about it. Of course she's passed now, but I used to kid her about taking her up on the elevator, and she'd laugh about it. But those things, you know, some of the things, so many little funny things that used to happen that I would laugh at it, and sometimes I'd go home and tell my parents, and they'd say, yeah, it didn't happen. Oh, it didn't happen. I'd say, oh, yes, it did. I'd have to prove to them that it didn't happen. But
well, now, how did you know the stories about the goober story and the elevators?
The goober story, I was there. But this other story, I wasn't there. One of the friends of mine told me this, that one, about the elevator. But the goober story, I seen that right out in the middle of the street with those peanuts, goobers. Oh, there's some funny. They said some very funny words, and they acted very funny on some cases. Some cases they just some of them were very prejudiced. And they wouldn't do, I don't know, if anybody was, another thing that some of them were, if you was light-complected, they didn't want to be bothered with you, you know, and they would say, well, there for a while, in fact, there for a while, some of them wouldn't have too much to do with me because they found me here. And he said, I talk funny. But it wasn't that. It's just, in fact, I almost had to push myself on some of them. That's just life for you, I guess. But of course, I made friends with them, and over the years, why? I made good friends because I married a girl from Mississippi. My wife's from Mississippi. She's from Indianola, Mississippi. So, I mean, she was born there, but she came here when she was real young, and. So she has never been back. She's asked me several times to go back. I said, uh-uh. See, I made one trip down there. I went with I think I had it on the other one. Made a trip down there with a man to drive his, move a man back to Mississippi, to Pontiac.
Go ahead, but I don't recall it.
A man by the name of Jim Ingram. He had, I think he had, somehow or another, he got sickly or something, and he went back to Mississippi. And he wanted somebody to drive his car back, and he had another man to drive to move him. This fellow loaded his furniture and everything on the truck, and I went to drive his car. I drove his car back down Mississippi, and I'd never been down there. And my brother told me, he said, you're crazy. He was living, my older brother said, told me, you're crazy. Well, we had a boy with us. This boy was born up here around Hillsboro, Wisconsin. And he was an oddball. See, we were afraid that he would say something down there that he didn't have no business saying, and we would catch it. So I went down there, and several places we stopped. Went in one place, wanted to go to the bathroom. Man wouldn't let us go to the bathroom. Another place, the fellow went in there to get some coffee for us because we was driving all night. They wouldn't even sell us coffee. Another place where he stopped, we had stayed outside till they brought the coffee out to us. It was on the road, too. Things have changed, though, they tell me since then. Much changed very much. Because this was way back there. And we went down there, and after getting down there, why, we went, first night we got there, why we went to, we wasn't going to bed right away. In fact, a lady that lived down there, she had two houses on her lot. The house that she lived in was really a nice house, nice home. It was really built and furnished up nice. But in this other house she had behind there, she rented it out to the boys that worked in the oil mill. And you could sit in that, lay in that house and look up to see the stars. But we stayed in this woman's good house. That night we went up to town to get some coffee or something. We had stand outside till this year, the Greek fella went and called, hollered in and told this cook that we wanted a bottle of coffee to take back. We had stand out on the sidewalk till this guy hollered to a colored woman to get the coffee for us. And then he went and got it and brought it to us at the door, at the curb there. I said, how could this? Now these are the things I think that the black man left there for. So I went on to, we went on back to the house where we were staying. We stayed there. Well, the fire broke out that night in the school, their colored school. And some of them said, come on, let's go to see the fire. I said, not me. Y'all go ahead. I'll stay here. I wasn't going there. So next day, we were planned on buying some sorghum and some sweet potatoes and things and bring them back. We figured we'd be able to sell them, you know, get some of that and bring it back and make a profit. Well, next day, we went out on a couple of farms there. And it was comical. The first place we went, it was we went and picked up a colored fella first. This colored fella taking us to this white man's place. This white man's name was McCord, too. Named Vander McCord. I don't know if that's where John and them got their name from or what, but anyhow, this man's name was McCord. He had a farm. We went to this colored guy, and this colored guy taking us to this white man. And we got in a truck, we went over to this fella's place, and we bought 20 or 30 gallons of sorghum. Then we wanted to buy some sweet potatoes. We taking us to another place. But this place where we went to get the sorghum, was there nothing out there on this plantation. I called it plantation, but a bunch of white people. Women were out there barefooted, and they had that thing going around grinding that sorghum, and then they're cooking it, and then some of them were barefooted, feet that long. They were all white, though. There wasn't no color there. And this colored guy, the funny thing about it, on our way, going from one place to the other, in from one car to the other, truck to the other, this colored fella had on a pair of shoes, and his shoes up here split right down the back, and his heels sticking out, and he had some wire to tie that heel back, the shoe together back there. And I really got mad at him down there. This white man said he was going to retire. He said, well, says, this guy spoke this way. He said, well, Mr. McCord, said, when you retire, says, let me, take me with you. Let me drive your car. Man said, well, John, you know how it is. Says, I won't be able to pay you. And this colored guy said, well, Mr. McCord, you know how old nigger is. All he wants is something to eat and a place to sleep. I wanted to hit him upside his head so bad I didn't know what to do. But that's the way they talk with each other. We went to this other place. There was a colored fella sitting on a rail. And a white man, him and this white man, was sitting up on a rail fence eating peanuts. And the women were out here chopping, stripping sorghum. And they identified this man the same way as this other guy did. Says, this white man wanted to know who we were and where we were from. So this colored man says, well, they're from up north. So they come from up there around Beloit, where my son is. Who did he bring down there? You know they brought that old, you know that nigger Bob uptown? Said they brought him down. That's a colored man telling a white man. See, well, the thing of it is, they expect that. See, they talk like that down there. So the white man says something like that to him, they can't say nothing. I was so glad when I left there, I didn't know what to do because I was nervous when I left. Mm-hmm. But it was quite a incident, and that's the reason why I said, I don't want to go back.
Why is your wife expressed an interest in going back down around Indianola?
She has relatives. And some of her distant relatives still are down there, but they're real distant. Most of her aunts and uncles have been here or passed from here, but she still has cousins or something down there that she has mentioned going to see. She'll probably see some of them in June because she's going to Atlanta, Georgia in June. She's flying down there to a church conference. See, I have a brother-in-law that is a minister and he's running for a bishop, and they will hold their conference in Atlanta, and they wanted us to come down there, but I have two other commitments I've got to do, and I can't go. In fact, I'm not too bothered about going.
You don't even want to go to Atlanta that bad.
No, no, I don't want to go to Atlanta that bad.
Any place south of the Ohio River, I guess.
That's it. See, I will go as far as Louisville, but I haven't been there but twice since I left. Yeah. I went there both times for a funeral. Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't been back.
You know, that's very interesting. And we were talking before about customs. And, in fact, we got on this by talking about customs that Mississippi folk brought mm-hmm. up to Beloit. I was wondering, when you and your family came up from Kentucky in Louisville, whether you were aware that you were bringing any customs or speech patterns that were different from...
I don't think so. Here. I could have, but I don't think so. All right. All right. There could have been some, but I didn't notice it. Mm-hmm. I heard...
Okay, we were talking here about customs again now.
I heard this when some of them, when one of the groups were coming here from Chicago, the conductor yelled, "Beloit, next stop, nobody move." And there was quite a few blacks on there that were coming to Beloit, and he knew they were. And so he hollered, "Fairbanks, Mars," says they all jumped up and started for the door. When he said Beloit, he didn't nobody move, but when he said Fairbanks, Mars, they all got up and got ready. But see, they wouldn't move, and we thought that was kind of comical for them to say Fairbanks Morris. Like, Beloit didn't mean nothing to them, but Fairbanks Morris did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just several instances like that had happened.
Now, this particular story, how did you know that? And you, are you sure that, are you...
I'm not positive that happened. No, I'm not positive. It's just something that I've heard repeated several times. Mm-hmm. But I am not sure that really happened. But it stands to reason that they did, because some of the people, when they first came up here, were very, well, I'll say naive.
You know, that story too is an indication that the people from Mississippi, they were coming to a company, not to a community.
They were coming to a company, not a community.
Right. And I'm wondering then, how did the community beyond, particularly the white community, beyond Fairbanks Morris, react to this influx of black folks from Mississippi? Do you recall anything along those lines?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the whites there for a while when they were coming, you know, they continue to come. I think the whites didn't like it. I'll be frank and tell you the truth. I'm almost sure, because I know this to be the fact right here. Some of the men had never worked in the shops, never did anything but down south there. And they would come to Fairbanks and work all day, 10 hours, working 10 hours then, get all sweaty and dirty, and they lived... Now, you know where Fairbanks Morris is down here. They'd come out of Fairbanks Morris, and the biggest majority of them at that time, when they lived down below the railroad tracks going towards South Beloit, past, if you know the town, they lived on the other side of St. Paul, lived down around St. Paul Avenue, Ray Street, places of that kind. And some of them would get on the streetcar, dirty, sooty, stinking. Well, you know good and well, in fact, if I'd been on the streetcar, I would have been ready to move or do something rather than to ride with somebody. You know, have you got your good clothes on or something, and somebody get on there all dirty and stinky and musty. You wouldn't want to sit beside them. Well, some of the white people I know resented that. They had to. I think some of the things, be frank and tell you the truth, just give the devil his dues. Let the chips fall where they will. A lot of the prejudice that was caused here in Beloit, the colored people brought it on themselves, because so many instances, they wasn't used to going in a restaurant, sitting down and being waited on. They wasn't used to walking in a saloon. At that time they had saloons, getting a drink. And because they were allowed these privileges, they went overboard with them. And if the person didn't come right up and ask them what they wanted and wait on them right away, they were being misused. It wasn't serving me because I'm black. And they'd raise a big storm about it. Well, I'm positive in some instances they were wrong. I know they were wrong. And when they first came up here, know this to be the truth. A lot of times we used to go to parties. And it'd be whites and blacks mixed up together, white girls, and mostly it was more white girls than would be colored girls. You'd be dancing around, having a good time, and all of a sudden one of the blacks would jump up, start a fight for nothing. And then it got to a place where the whites wouldn't mingle with the blacks, because they were overbearing, they hadn't been used to it, and want to bully you. We brought a lot of it on ourselves.
Do you recall any specific incidents or instances that would illustrate that point?
No, right now I couldn't call any particular instance, but I know it has happened, because on some instances, I know that I've been in the midst of some things and would try to talk to somebody and try to tell them, well, you know, not to do this and not to do that, because it was just be hurting yourself. Of course, they call me all kinds of names too, so I know it to be the truth, though.
What would you be called? What were some of the names that were used?
All kinds of sons of so-and-so's, white folks, niggas and everything else, see?
Now, what was the result then of this? You paint a picture of increasing tension because the black folks from Mississippi just were not used to living in an urban society, really.
I think.
And what was the end result of that?
Well, the thing of it is, I'm going to have to come back to you because something else has flashed back in my mind.
Sure. Okay.
About recruiting.
Oh, okay,
good. J.D. Stevenson came here from Alabama, from Tuskegee, Alabama, and he influenced quite a few men from Tuskegee to come up here and work. Then Fairbanks Morris built what they called at that time a YMCA out here on 6th Street. And some of these men were talented. Some were not. But J.D. then started working with trying to get, by that time, Emmanuel Baptist Church had started, and they got a minister here by the name of Reverend W.E.W. Brown. You probably have heard that name before. W.E.W. Brown.
Talk about him in detail, so whatever you recall about him.
W.E.W. Brown and J.D. Stevenson and this man, Leon Peterson, they were had a little bit more education and know-how to come in between And they started to get with this group, with mingle with these men, these other older men. And they finally got the group settled. The churches started organizing together. And that separated some of it, started separating some of it. J.D. Stevenson had a very good, he played a real good part in it. And W.W. Brown played a very good part in it. And this other one was, Leon. Oh, there's several of them there. And then a man by the name of Jim Gordon. They did their part in trying to resurrect things and change it about. They did change there for a while, and we got a place where it was a little different. Then they started coming back. It got to the place there for a while where it was really rough, because the black people had just got way off from it. Got overboard. And it takes something like that to get them back. Well, then,
no,
a kind of a panic got in between there, too, where you didn't have the money. See, you take...
After World War
I. Yeah, you take the money away from a person where you can't buy nothing. You can't buy your liquor and you can't do that. Then you get humble. So some of that had something to do with it, too.
You introduce a very interesting point there, which is that perhaps during World War I, when there was plenty of work, the folks who migrated in had more money than they were ever used to dealing
yes.
with. Is that...
That's it. They had more money than they had ever had, or I presume some of them more than they ever had in their life, or ever had to use of their own. So they just went overboard, buying everything they wanted. And
now, when you say going overboard, just specifically, what do you
well,
mean?
Well, spending, what were some drinking, and carousing around, wouldn't work half the time, just staying in the street drunk or something of that kind.
Did you ever observe or hear or recall people talking about difficulties that people who came in from a rural setting to work in a factory environment, were there many problems that people had getting used to that new kind of working situation? Those who came in for the most part were farmers, or handymen type workers.
Mostly.
And yet, and now they were working, they were getting into a very structured, highly regimented working situation. Mm-hmm. Now, did that pose any problems that you recall?
That posed a big problem, because, see, the biggest majority of them, the only jobs that they ever held other than farming was in the oil mills or something like that. Or on the railroad.
When you speak of oil mills, you're talking about
cottonseed oil. See, those are the only kind of jobs they had down there. That's what it's told to me.
Well, now, what kinds of problems resulted from this situation where rural workers were coming into a factory situation?
Well, they came into here and they was making more money. That was the biggest problem. They was making more money than they'd been used to making. And they just... You take a child, you give him more money, what he knows what to do with, well, he's going to do with almost anything. Go crazy with it.
Did most stay in Beloit, or did many move on? What is your recollection of that?
Some, it's a lot. It was quite a few stayed. I would say the biggest majority of them stayed here. But then it started a... kind of a, I would say, I don't know how I would describe it, but they would go from here to Milwaukee and then make a circle back to Chicago or somewhere, then they started going to Michigan, Muskegon, Michigan, and up in there. And then the group would be coming steadily from different places, like you said about Murfreesboro, Illinois, down in there. They started coming from all over the South after these Mississippi people got here. They started coming from Tennessee, Illinois, the lower part of Illinois, began to come in here, but a lot of them didn't stay here. They would go on to various places. Some of them would go to Washington, Tacoma, Seattle, up in there, but most of them would go to Milwaukee. Then next time you heard from them, they'd be in Michigan somewhere. But the biggest majority of them, it's still Mississippi. Below it is practically Mississippi yet. It's very few people. I think you'd find out that out of every 10 people you talk to, 8 would be from Mississippi. That's a rough way I see it, but maybe I'm wrong, but I think, blacks.
Yeah.